Ibn Ezra asks a question at the beginning of this week's Sedra. He says, why did the Rabban Shem go to such great lengths to prevent Bilam from cursing the Jewish people? Now, sticks and stones can break your bones, but let Bilam do whatever he wants, and the Rabban Shem will make it ineffective. What difference did it make if Bilam actually cursed them or not? The Rabban Shem can protect them. There are other answers to this question. But the Ibn Ezra says the following. HaKadosh Baruch Hu knew that 24,000 Jews were going to die because of the Maisa Baal Peor. And if Bilam had cursed the Jewish people, it may appear that they died because of his curse. And therefore the Rabban Shem didn't let him curse them, so no one would think that that's the reason they died. That's the Ibn Ezra. L'chaora bothers me, the whole concept. What would be better? That the world should know that 24,000 Jews committed sins of immorality and therefore they died? Or to think that they died because Bilam cursed them? I don't know, my estimation, I think we'd better a cover-up. That they died because Bilam cursed them and Nebuch. Instead of knowing that 24,000 Jews committed immorality and that's why they died. That's what the Rabban Shem wanted. Why was it worse that they should think that they died because of Bilam's curse? Thinking that perhaps the idea is similar to something we mentioned last week. Last week we said that one of the explanations of the sin of Moshe Rabbeinu by Mei Meriva was that he called the Jewish people Morim, Shimuno HaMorim. And we asked, but he said that again, even worse, Mamrim Hayisim Mashem. And we explained there's a difference between calling and labeling the Jewish people Morim, or castigating them for what they did, for being rebellious, or being rebels. Klal Yisrael is in essence holy and pure. We are not rebels. We are good, wholesome people. Sometimes we are rebellious. We do things that are bad, and then we have to be punished or have to be rebuked or whatever. But that does not mean that we are intrinsically bad people. Because if we would be, why would HaKadosh Baruch Hu have chosen us? And someone who thinks or even intimates that the Jewish people are bad people, intrinsically lack faith in the Rabban Shalom, because the Rabban Shalom chose us, so we don't really trust him or have faith in him that he knows what he's doing. In this week's Sedra, Rashi says a very strange thing in the name of the Medrash. Lo hibit oven biyakov. God does not look at sins amongst the Jewish people. And Rashi says, even when they sin, the Rabban Shalom is not medaktek. He's not careful to be very exacting with their sins, right? And the Medrash says, "Eino roeh be'averos shalohem ela be'geyusa." He doesn't look at their sins; he looks at their pride, how great they are, geyusa. Now that seems to contradict a Chazal, because Chazal say, "Kol ha'omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu vatron yivasru me'yoi." Anyone who says that the Rabban Shem overlooks sins, his inside should be overlooked. It's not true. The Rabban Shem is medaktek and with tzaddikim kechut asar even. So what does it mean? God is not medaktek after their sins. Of course he is. What it means is the Rabban Shalom looks at the sins not as the intrinsic part of the Jewish people, but as something they do. But he's more impressed with what we are than what we do. And that is brought out by another medrash on a different pasuk in this week's Sedra. Bilam said, "Ma ekov lo kabo Hashem. What can I curse that God didn't curse?" And Rashi brings down over there, even when they're cursed, he doesn't curse them, he curses their anger. Yaakov Avinu wanted to curse Shimon and Levi for what they did in Shechem. He didn't say, "Orer Shimon v'Levi," curse them. But "Orer Apam," he cursed their anger. Again, the same idea. Klal Yisrael are not susceptible to a curse. because intrinsically they are pure and holy. But what they do can be cursed. Their anger is cursed, not them. What is this concept? There is a concept in Yiddish, it's called the Pintel Yid. In Hebrew, it's a Nitzutz HaKedusha. There's a spark of holiness that is at the source of every Jewish soul. And the Sfasemis calls that Mogin Avram. When we say in Shimon Esrei, Mogin Avram, this is the shield that Avram Avinu created through his tremendous righteousness. And he created what is genetically part of the makeup, the genetic spiritual makeup of the Jewish people, that is passed on from generation to generation. Every Jewish soul has an aspect of it that is not possible to corrupt, to pollute, to change. This is what Chazal say, Ritzoneinu lasos ritzonecha. Every Jewish soul, without exception, is screaming deep down inside, we want to do God's will. So why doesn't it? Because there are other wills superimposed on that will, not to change it. That will never goes away. That source, foundation of our soul that is pure and holy is never changed. It's never corrupted. It's always pure and holy. The most that can happen is that it gets suppressed. It gets covered over by other wills. And that is not only a nice hashkafic idea, it has halachic repercussions, halachic implications. The Rambam explains in Hilchas Gerushin, based on a Gemara in Bava Basra. The Gemara says that there's a concept of kofin oso achi yomer rotzani. You can force somebody to do something till he says he wants to do it. And then it's not considered coerced, it's considered that he did it willingly. Example. In order for a get to be a get, for a woman to be divorced, the husband has to write a get, the right nusach, whatever. He also has to give it to his wife voluntarily, with full volition. If he's forced to give it, it's no get. If he doesn't give it on his own volition, it's not a good get. That's clear. It's like he gave her a comic book. It's not a get. She's still a married woman. Sometimes the halacha is that we force a person to give a get, which on the surface seems impossible, because if you force him, he didn't give it willingly, and therefore it's not a get. So how does it work? So the Gemara says, when does it work? When halachically the person has to give a get. It's prohibited for him to remain married. It's a marriage. Sometimes somebody can marry somebody when it's prohibited and there's no marriage. A father gives his daughter a ring and says, Hariat Mekudeshesli, in front of witnesses, she's not a married woman. Because it's impossible for a marriage to be effected between a father and a daughter. But a Kohen who gives a grusha, a divorcee, a ring in front of Edom and says, Hariat Mekudeshesli, it's a good kedusha. Except it's prohibited. So she's a married woman, she's married to this Kohen, she's not allowed to live with him. And we want them to get divorced. They shouldn't be married to each other when they can't live together without transgressing a prohibition. So in the time when the Beis Din had the power, we call the person in and we say, Mr. Cohen, we understand that you married a divorcee. You're a Cohen. That's prohibited. So we'd like you to divorce her. And Mr. Cohen would say, sorry, but I love my wife, not divorcing her. They say, are you sure? He said, yeah, I have no intention to divorce her at all. So I'll see you. They say, no, you won't see us. They grab him and they tie him to a pole. And they say, Mr. Cohen, are you sure you don't want to divorce your wife? And he says, yeah, I'm 100% sure. They said, then we have no choice. We're going to have to beat you. So they bring out a whip and they start beating him. They beat him and he's really, really hurts. And they ask him again, Mr. Cohen, are you sure you don't want to divorce your wife? And he says, yeah, I'm sure. They said, okay, beat him more. Finally, he's a bloody pulp. They go over, bend over and say, Mr. Cohen, are you sure you don't want to divorce your wife? He says, you know what? I think I changed my mind. I think I'd like to divorce her. Just fine. Tell the sofer to write the get. Tell the witnesses to witness it. We know that you can't give it over because you're a little not disposed to that fact, since you're lying on the floor in a pool of blood. So appoint this shliach to give your wife the get. He appoints an agent. The agent gives it. Mazel tov, they're divorced. Why? Because we forced him till he said yes. So it's a good get. He did it voluntarily. Says the Rambam, who are we fooling? When he said yes, he means yes, I want you to stop beating me. We know he doesn't want to divorce his wife. How can you coerce somebody to do something voluntarily? That's coercion. Says the Rambam, when Mr. Cohn came to court, he really wanted to divorce his wife deep down inside, because his neshama always, deep down, wants to do Ratzon Hashem. Except the Yetzer Hara superimposed other desires on top of that, that muffled that desire and suppressed it. Didn't change it, it was there. But it couldn't escape. So when we beat him, we didn't beat him into submission. We didn't beat him to change his mind that he should want to divorce his wife. He always wanted to divorce her. Except that will was entrapped, muffled, stifled by other superimposed wills. So when we beat him, all we did is beat away the things that interfered and suppressed his real will and let his real will come to the surface. If we had to change his will, you can't change somebody's will by coercion, and then it's called doing something willfully. But you can take away all the things that prevent his will from coming to the surface, and that's his will that was there from the beginning. So it's a fact, not just a nice idea, it's a halachic fact that every single Jew wants to do Ratzon Hashem deep down inside. He's Kodesh Vitar. And that's why the Avod on Yom Kippur, the Maral, says, represents this idea. We take two goats. A goat on the outside represents Yetzer Hara. Se'irim Rok Duba. The goat is a symbol of the Yetzer Hara. There's something interesting about the goat, says the Maral. The blood of a goat is the most similar blood to the blood of a human being. So we take one of the goats and we send it off a cliff. External, the Yetzer Hara, we can send away. But the other goat, we slaughter, and we take the inner blood and we bring it into the Holy of Holies. That's a Jew. On the outside, he may look like a goat. He may look like Yetzer Hara. He may look evil. But that can be separated. It's just an external thing. It's sent away. And if you delve deeply enough inside the Jew, you'll find blood that is human, that's fit to go into the Holy of Holies. That's a Jew. On the outside, he may look like a Seir, like the Yetzer Hara. But deep down inside, he's holy, Holy of Holies. There's a Medrash, the Maral says, that brings that out. If you have two people in a field, and you're winnowing grain, so the chaff comes pouring down on them, one of them's bald, and the other one has very thick, curly hair. So the chaff gets intertwined in the curly one's hair, and it rests on the bald head of the bald guy. With the bald guy, all you have to do is blow, and all the chaff separates from him. With the guy with the curly, thick hair, it's entangled in his hair. It's almost impossible to get all the chaff out. Esav was Esau-ir. He's a hairy person. The sins become entwined in him. They become part of his essence. It's hard to separate them. But Yaakov, Ishtam, he was smooth. The sins just lie there on the surface. All you have to do is separate them. And what's there intrinsically is holy and pure. The that's the case, then we can understand pretty much the Ibn Ezra. How does a klala work? It's the opposite of a bracha. How does a bracha work? The word bracha, the Rashba says, means to increase. Bracha means to increase. That's why you can't have a bracha unless you start with something. A bracha can't be chal on nothing, because you can't multiply nothing and make it something. And no matter how many times you multiply, it remains nothing. But if you start with something and you multiply it, it becomes bigger. That's why when Elisha did the miracle for the woman who had no money and she had a mortgage off her kids or whatever, so he asked her, do you have any oil in the house? from that oil, he made a bracha. It didn't stop. But if she had nothing, he couldn't make a bracha of something from nothing. It has to be something there. Klala is just the opposite. A klala is to take kal, something that is light, something negative, and increase that. So when you multiply a negative, you get more of a negative. So a klala is to intensify a negative, and a bracha is to intensify a positive. A klala can only work if there's something there for the klala to take effect on. If God would have let Bilam give the Jewish people a klala, it would have implied that there's something intrinsically wrong with them that Bilam's klala can intensify and increase, and that's why they died. And that would have given the impression there's something intrinsically wrong, something intrinsically not pure and holy about the essence of the Jewish people. On the other hand, if we know they died because they sinned, that doesn't say anything about their essence. It says something about what they do, what they add to that essence. Yeah, Jews can be terrible people and do terrible things, but they are not terrible people. They do terrible things, but they're not terrible people. So if it would have had the impression that Bilam's curse was effective, it would have implied that there's something intrinsically wrong with the Jewish people. Whereas dying because they committed a terrible sin only tells me there's something wrong with their actions, not with who they are. That, I think, is pshat in the Ibn Ezra. Any questions on this? If not, we'll go to another topic. The Chafetz Chaim points out that this Sedra is unique. There are only really, I think, two other Sedras in the Torah that are similar to this. Its uniqueness is that it has no Parshios. There's a misnomer. People call it Parshas HaShavua. It's not really Parshas HaShavua. It's Parshios HaShavua, or the Sedra. Parsha is paragraph. In the Torah, there are different kinds of paragraphs. There's a Parsha Stuma, a Parsha Psucha. If you look at a Sefer Torah, so a Parsha Stuma is where the line starts with a few words, stops, there's an empty space till the end of the column, and then the next line starts a new line. Not much like a paragraph. There's another kind of Parsha, that's called a Parsha Psucha. There's a Parsha Stuma. Parsha Stuma means that the words stop, then there's a space, and the next word is on the same line, but after a space of 9 letters. So the space in the middle of a line, or the space at the end of the line. Those are two kind of parshios, paragraphs. There are no parshios in Bullock. It's all run on line after line after line, no paragraphs. Says the Chafetz Chaim. The Gemara says, what function did the Parshios have? They are an integral part of the Sefer Torah. If you write a Sefer Torah or Tefillin or Mezuzah without the Parshios properly marked, right, composed, the Sefer Torah, the Tefillin, the Mezuzah is possible. The paragraphs are a part of the makeup of the Torah. So what was their function? Says the Gemara, the function of the Parshios was to give Moshe time to contemplate, to think about what he was taught. God taught him a certain amount of information, and then he told him, think about it, ponder it, contemplate it. Says the Chafetz Chaim, that is the foundational difference between Bilam and Moshe. They both had the same potential. Moshe Rabbeinu thought, pondered, reviewed what he was taught. And Bilam never bothered to think about it. He just took it in his stride and went on. If you don't think, if you don't ponder, then the most amazing things will pass you by, and you will, what's it called, it'll make no impression on you. And that's why Bilam remained the Rasha, and Moshe Rabbeinu became Moshe Rabbeinu. Because Moshe Rabbeinu thought. He contemplated. He deliberated. He reviewed. That's the difference. I have a proof to that Chafetz Chaim. Not that he needs my proof, but it's a medrash. open Medrash. Medrash says that before the plague of Borod, of hail, Moshe Rabbeinu told Paro, if whoever will bring their cattle into the house, out of the field, then the hail will not affect them and they'll live. But whoever leaves their cattle out in the field, it's going to be decimated by the hail. So the Torah says, Hayoreis Devar Hashem, the person who feared God's word and took Moshe seriously, Heinises Mikneo Minasodi, brought his cattle in from the field, and it survived. Vasher Lo Sam Libo, and the person who didn't pay attention, didn't take notice, left his cattle in the field, and it was killed. Says the Medrash, it sounds like it's not just talking about a group of people amongst Paro's servants who were God-fearing, and a group that didn't pay attention. It's Mashman talking about somebody specific that represented that group. Hayoreis Devar Hashem, the one who was God-fearing. Says the Medrash, who's it referring to specifically? Yisro. Yisro was a servant of Paro, one of Paro's advisors. He was a God-fearing man. When he heard Moshe say, whoever doesn't bring their cattle in is going to die, he brought his cattle in. He took Moshe seriously. Vasher lo sam libo, and that servant of Paro who didn't take it to heart, who didn't take notice, who was that? Bilam. Now you'll notice it doesn't say that Bilam was a person who didn't fear God. It doesn't say Vasher lo yoreis devar Hashem, and the one who didn't fear God left his cattle in the field. No. Bilam also feared God. He was a prophet. But lo sam libo, he didn't take notice. He didn't put his heart to it. He didn't think about it. He just, in his stride, took it and it just passed over him. And that is exactly what the Chofetz Chaim says. That was the shortcoming of Bilam. And therefore there's no parshios in the Sedra of Balak because Bilam never thought about what he was hearing, what he experienced. He just took it in his stride. And another proof to that is how Bilam reacted when his donkey spoke to him. Anybody here have a dog or cat as a pet? Yeah? Fine. You ever took your dog for a walk? And let's say you were taking the dog for a walk and you started to walk briskly. And the dog turned around and said, could you slow the pace a little fast for me? What do you think you do? Scream? Faint? Call the newspapers? Right? Ripley's Believe It or Not? Something, right? What wouldn't you do? Answer the dog and say, I'm sorry, I'm in a rush. We have to go fast. That's what you would not do. Okay? Only somebody out of their mind would just casually answer the dog as if he's talking to his friend. No donkey ever talked in the history of the world before this. Never. To anyone. And the donkey turns around and says to Bilam, what are you hitting me for? Do I deserve this? And instead of Bilam fainting, screaming, telling his guy, hey, did you hear that? He answers the donkey like his friend is talking to him, like there's nothing special. Why? Because when you don't think about something and you're not prepared for it, the most miraculous things pass you by and you don't notice them. That's Bilam. Bilam didn't think. He didn't take notice. He didn't consider what was going on. And everything just passed over him as it was nothing. That is the idea. And that is the foundation of all destruction. Another week we're going to celebrate or commemorate Shivasa B'Tammuz. Either it's going to be a Yontif, Mashiach comes, or it's going to be a fast day. One of the two. We're going to commemorate no matter what. So Shivasa B'Tammuz is coming up as some kind of commemoration. And it says there were sins that caused the first Beis HaMikdash to destroy, different sins that caused the second Beis HaMikdash, but the prophet Yirmiyahu says, where do those sins come from? How come we sin? How come we sunk to such a low level that we committed sins that were worthy of destroying the Beis HaMikdash and putting us into Galus for 70 years, for thousands of years? Says Yirmiyahu very simply, Yoda Shor Koneyu, an ox knows its master. V'chamor evus ba'alav. And a donkey is not smart enough to know whose master is. But he knows where he gets his food from. He doesn't bite the hand that feeds it. The shore knows whose master is. Yisrael lo yada. Klal Yisrael didn't know who our master is. We didn't know even who's feeding us. We bit the hand that feeds us. Why? Because ami lo hisbonan, because we didn't think. What is instinctive to an animal, a human being doesn't think, he doesn't know. Animals have no intelligence. So God gave them instinct to take its place. So they instinctively know things. That's their form of intelligence. But human beings have free will and intelligence. And we can choose to know or not to know. So God didn't give us those instincts. He let us choose to know what an animal knows instinctively. But if we don't think about it, then it's going to pass us by, and what an animal knows by instinct, we won't know. So an animal knows who its master is, where its feed comes from, but Klal Yisrael doesn't know because they don't think. And if you don't think, the simplest, most obvious things pass you by. So that is the, and there's another Sedra, which doesn't have Parshios. There's really two more. But we're not going to go into the third one because it doesn't fit this idea. But the second one does, even though there's other reasons why the second one too. The second parsh of Sedra that doesn't have Parshios is Vayetze. Vayetze speaks about the episodes between Yaakov and Lavan. And the Zohar says that Lavan and Bilam was a Gilgal of Lavan. He was a spin-off. I like to call it a reincarnation, but it's not really a reincarnation. It means that Bilam and Lavan shared common souls. Not that they had the same soul, but they had they were part of the same cluster of souls. And therefore they had a connection with each other. So if Bilam Sedra doesn't have Parshios, as the Chafetz Chaim says, to let us know that Bilam never thought, contemplated, then the same Bilam who was Lavan, also his Sedra also doesn't have Parshios, because he didn't think either. That was what Lavan's shortcoming was, same as Bilam. Okay. Let's go to another. Any questions on this idea? Go to another idea. Torah says, Hein am levadod yishkon. Bilam looks at us and he says, we are a nation that dwells apart. And I think we spoke about this concept at some point. I'm going to go into it and elaborate on it more. The Jewish people dwell apart. We do not isolate ourselves from the world, but we insulate ourselves from the world. Badad has the same connotation as the modern Hebrew word called bidud. Bidud means insulation. We are insulated from the world. In 1 second, we'll discuss what that means. And therefore, we dwell uva goyim lo yischashov. We don't count amongst the other nations of the world. We have to remain separate from them. Why? There's a Rashi in the end of Parshas Achrimos, or Kedosh, in the end of Parshas Shmini, that says, Vo'avdil eschem min ho'amim lios li. I separated you from the nations of the world to be mine. And on that, Rashi brings a chazal, Im atem muvdolim atem shali. If you separate yourselves from the nations of the world, then you're mine. Ve'im lav, and if not, atem shal Nebuchadnezzar v'chaveiroth. You belong to Nebuchadnezzar and his friends. Now the simple meaning probably is that if you separate yourself from the abominations that the nations do, they burn their children to their gods, and that they murder each other, and they do all kinds of immoral things, then you're mine, I'll protect you. But if you don't separate yourself from the nations of the world, and you do all these terrible things that they do, then I'll give you over into the hands of your enemies like Nebuchadnezzar. That's probably the simple way of understanding it, but that's not, can't be what it means. It doesn't say that. It doesn't say I'll give you over into the hands of Nebuchadnezzar. It says you belong to Nebuchadnezzar. If you do this, you belong to me. If not, you belong to him. And why mention Nebuchadnezzar? We had plenty of enemies before him and after him. Why did you just say, I'll give you into the hands of your enemies? Why specifically Nebuchadnezzar? Why did we belong to him? So in order to illustrate what this Rashi means, I'm going to tell you a story. I don't remember if I told the story here this year, surely in the past years I may have said it at some point, but this year I don't remember, and if I did, I guarantee that I heard it from me more times than you did. So you hear it again. It's a good idea to hear the story. It brings out the point. I was once on a plane traveling from New York to Cleveland, and the plane was taxiing on the runway, and all of a sudden it pulled off the runway and stopped and just sat there. We weren't taking off. We were just sitting on the side of the runway. This went for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, half an hour, 45 minutes. Everybody's getting very nervous. What's wrong with the plane? Why are we sitting here? And they're not telling us anything. No information. So everybody was very nervous. For some reason, I guess they didn't want to tell us what was wrong. So, and they didn't want people to be nervous. So they started giving out free alcoholic beverages. Free drinks. On the house. The Irishman behind me, who was in his mid-50s, had a few of these drinks. And he became very happy. And he got up from his seat, which is right behind my seat, and he goes walking around the plane looking for familiar faces of people from Cleveland who had been in New York and were going back to Cleveland. He obviously was in Cleveland, he was returning home. He found about 6 friends that he recognized on the plane, and he told them, I want you to come around my seat, which was around my seat. I want to tell you a story. Now, this guy was talking so loud that if I was in another plane, I could have heard him. Earplugs wouldn't have helped. He was drunk, and he didn't realize how loud he was talking. But that's how loud he was talking. Everybody in the plane heard him. There was no way of escaping hearing what he was going to say. So I was hoping that it was not something that I wasn't allowed to listen to, because there was no choice. And I figured if the Rabbanu Shlom was putting me in this position, there must be something here I'm going to learn something from. So I paid attention to the story. And more or less, this is the story word for word. The guy tells his friends, you know, my wife died about 6 months ago, and I've been in a terrible depression since then. My son, who's a wealthy physician in New York, called me up a few weeks ago, and he said, Dad, you're in a terrible depression because of our mother's death, your wife's death, and I want to get you out of the depression. I want you to come to New York on my expense. I'll put you up in a 5-star hotel for 10 days, and every day I will show you some of the sights of New York. You never saw the big city. And it'll get your mind off your wife's, my mother's death, and maybe we'll get you out of this depression. So I took my son up on it, and Itaka put me up in a beautiful hotel, and every day took me somewhere else in New York to see the sights of the city, the Empire State Building and the Statue of Liberty and so on and so on and so on. So, but last night was the zenith of my trip. Last night my son took me to one of the 10 most luxurious restaurants in the world that happens to be in New York. And he mentioned the name of the restaurant. I didn't catch it because I'm sure the kashrus isn't up to my standards, so it didn't really make a difference to me what the name of the restaurant was. But he mentioned the name of a restaurant. He said, you have no idea of the opulence of this place. We came to this restaurant. They sat us down at a table that was fit for King Arthur. Everybody had their own little throne. And they gave us a menu. I couldn't even read half the menu. But I noticed that the most expensive item on the menu was a 3-pound steak dinner consisting of 7 courses from soup to nuts. Now, you have to understand what that means. And the main course was 3 pounds of steak plus side dishes, and that was only the main course. There were 6 other courses. Now, 3 pounds of steak is the following. In a fast food place, the big hamburgers are 1/4 pound. That means 12 of them is 3 pounds. A little cow is what they serve for this meal. 3-pound steak, and that's just the main course. The guy said, I said to myself, I don't know if I'll ever be in a restaurant like this in my life again. My son can afford it. I'm going for the top of the menu. So I ordered the 3-pound steak dinner. They served it, and I ate it from soup to nuts, finished the whole thing. When I finished the meal, finished dessert, they all of a sudden appeared at my table 2 very distinguished-looking gentlemen with tuxedos on. And one of them was holding a scroll. And the one with the scroll introduced himself. He said, I'm the maitre d' of this restaurant. And the man with me is the owner of the restaurant. We want you to know that you are the seventh person in the history of this restaurant that ordered the 3-pound, 7-course steak meal and finished it and didn't ask for a doggy bag. And we have a scroll printed up with blanks for this occasion, this kind of occasion. And we will fill in your name and tonight's date, and we'll give you the scroll as a memento and as a remembrance of this great feat of finishing the 3-pound, 7-course steak dinner in our restaurant tonight. So they filled in his name with calligraphy, and they filled in the date, and they handed him the scroll, and the man's eyes were now tearing. He said, "You have no idea how I felt when they handed me the scroll." He said, "But that was nothing." After they hand me the scroll, they say, "Look opposite your table at the wall, opposite your table, and you will see 6 bronze plaques with names and dates on them. Those are the names and dates of the 6 people before you that finished the 7-course 3-pound steak dinner in our restaurant. Tomorrow we're going out and buying a 7th bronze plaque with your name and tonight's date, and your name will be on the wall of our restaurant for all posterity. Whoever comes here will see that you finished the 3-pound 7-course steak tonight." At that point, I wanted to turn around and interrupt and say, were there little bulbs on those bronze plaques? Because that would not have said very good things about what happened to the 6 people before who finished the meal. But I kept my mouth shut. And the man now was crying. Mama's like a baby. Crying like a baby. He said, "You have no idea how I feel. I feel fulfilled. I don't know if I have any other purpose to live." That's what he said, word for word. At that point, I started to daven very earnestly that before this plane takes off, someone who heard this story, and everybody on the plane heard it, stand up and say he knows a restaurant that serves a 4-pound, 7-course steak meal. What difference did it make to me? I was afraid in the heavenly court, they heard what this guy said, and they said, "You know what, he's right, he has no more purpose to live." And when the plane takes off, they're taking him down, and I'm sitting right in front of him, I don't know if I could survive. So I was hoping that he have a purpose to live before we took off. A non-Jew, and I don't intimate that this is the raison d'etre of most non-Jews, but I'm saying for argument's sake, a non-Jew could live a life where his entire focus of life is to eat 3 pounds of steak in a 7-course meal in a fancy restaurant. As long as he doesn't steal the meat, he doesn't curse God because it's too tough, he doesn't serve idolatry, he's not immoral, he doesn't take the meat from a living animal, and he didn't serve idolatry, he'll get a share in the world to come. But if a Jew lives a life like that, he's not going to get a share in the world to come. Because God expects more from us. We have a mission not just to be moral. A non-Jew can live a moral life and he'll get a share in the world to come. He doesn't have to be holy. We are a mamleches kohanim v'goy kadosh. We are a nation of priests. We represent God to the world. How do we do it? By living a holy existence where every aspect of our life is holy. Our married life, our social life, our political life, our economic life, holiness. Not just morality, beyond morality. A holy, godly way of living. That's what we're supposed to do. And if we live that kind of life, then we create a temple. We're the temple. We're the place where God's presence devolves in this world. V'asuli mikdash v'shochanti bisocham. God dwells amongst us, not in the temple. We are the temple. So if we separate ourselves from the nations of the world and we live a holy existence, a mamleches kohanim, the goy kadosh, then we belong to God. We're his representatives. But if we don't, we belong to a different club. We belong to Nebuchadnezzar. What did Nebuchadnezzar do? Destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. We also destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. Except we're destroying the Beis HaMikdash of our heart. He destroyed a bunch of wood and stones. That's what it means. So we are an Am Levodad Yishko. We're a nation that dwells apart. That's how Bilam saw us. We have to remain insulated from the nations of the world. Not the worst of them, the best of them. Because our mission and our lifestyle is different. We have to have a holy lifestyle, not just a moral one. A goy can get away and will get a share in the world to come for living morally. We have to be beyond morality. We have to be holy. And we really have no choice. God didn't ask us if we want that mission. He gave it to us and we're responsible for it. And therefore, whether we like it or not, we are going to remain separate, apart from the nations of the world. If we choose to do it willingly, we will read the pasuk Vayishkon Yisrael Betach Badad. We'll read the pasuk that we dwell in security apart from the nations of the world, and we'll be able to live with them in peace. But if we choose not to separate ourselves, to assimilate amongst the nations of the world, we'll try to assimilate, then the Medrash says that we're compared to oil, and the nations of the world are compared to water. You can't mix oil and water. You can try. But what eventually happens? The globules of oil rise to the surface. So it's impossible. We can try to assimilate, but in the end we won't. And then we'll read, we'll still be badad, we'll still be separate and apart. But we'll read a different pasuk. Eicha yashva vadad. We'll say that pasuk sitting on the floor after a churban. Not on Simchas Torah, when we'll say it with tremendous simcha. Reb Chaim Volozhiner says it very poignantly. He says we only have two choices. Either the Jew makes Kiddush, or the Goy will make Havdalah. Either we sanctify ourselves, and in that way, separate and live apart from the nations of the world. And if we don't, and we try to assimilate, then the Goy will make Havdalah, he'll push us out. Just like the analogy to the water and the oil. If you try to mix the oil globules into the water, you know what pushes the oil to the surface? The pressure of the water. The water pushes us out. And that's been our history. Whether it was Egypt or Spain or Germany, whenever we tried to assimilate into the water pressure pushed us to the surface again. Pushed us out from amongst them. So that's what Bilam saw. Hein am levodad yishkon. And the place where that apartness is possible is Eretz Yisrael. In Eretz Yisrael, we're supposed to create a holy society. Eretz Yisrael is a holy land where it's easier to take every aspect of life, social, married, economic, political, every aspect of life, and make it holy. The antithesis of secular Zionism. Secular Zionism was created so the Jewish people could be normal. Herzl reasoned that there's anti-Semitism in the world because we're not normal. We live in other people's lands, speak their language, make use of their economies, their post office, their army, whatever. We're a bunch of parasites, so they hate us. But if we'd have our own land and our own language and our own post office and our own army and subsequent Zionist thinkers added, and our own criminals and our own perverts, then we'd be normal like everybody. And they wouldn't hate us any more than they hate each other. Which I don't know how great anyway that is, but at least they wouldn't single us out. So they wanted a place where we could be normal, just like the nations of the world. It didn't work. They don't love us even though we're apart and we have our own post office and our own perverts and our own criminals, everything. They still hate us. It's not the solution to anti-Semitism. The purpose of Eretz Yisrael is that we should be apart. We should have our own army and our own post office, everything. But holy, not the same as the nations of the world. In a way that bespeaks godliness. We're on the way to that in the modern state of Israel, at least politically. Because when the nations of the world hear about Israeli politics, what do they say? Oh my God. So we remind them of God through our politics. In any case, I don't know if that's what the Rabban Shalom had in mind. So that's what Bilam saw. An am levodad yishko. And that's how we have to be. We have to be a people that dwell apart, not isolated from the world. We're part of the world, but we're insulated from the world. And by remaining insulated, we're able to develop our own unique kind of society, our own unique lifestyle that fulfills our mission of being a Mamleches Kohanim, the Goy Kadosh, a nation that represents God by living a holy existence.